Greetings from BBS Radio, where truth and news still exist in the original form. You're tuned in to The Spiritual Politician, the show that shows you where politics and government went wrong and how you can help make it right. I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster, your host for this hour of personal empowerment. If you have a question, suggestion, or insight, call us toll-free at 1-888-268-4313 or call direct 530-876-3222. This show is carried online, and you may also be able to get it on the air in your local area. To find out if an on-air station in your area is carrying this show, contact us through bbsradio.com. The website for this show is up now, and this show and all other shows can be heard through your computer from our show archives. Most people wonder about the title of our show because it seems like an oxymoron to link the words spiritual and politician. But if you think about it, you see pretty quickly that we're living in a world where we're starting to rethink nearly everything because we have to. Politics has turned into an enormous game, with teams we think of as political parties, but Republicans 10, Democrats 2, does not say much about who we are as people of faith and as Americans. Politics today is all about winning, so those in charge can grab the cash and the clout. They've all lost track of two very important facts. The first thing is who we really are. We're all Americans. America started with the idea we're all inherently free. We're free to choose, free to live, to breathe, and to live our lives as we see fit. Government does not own us. Government is just a hired contractor providing some services. That's the first thing. The second thing is even more important to many of us. Before we are Americans, we're all members of a human family that connects us to something much larger than any one of us. Christians, Muslims, Jews, Buddhists, nearly all people see themselves as connected to something ineffable, a presence that draws us into a relationship with each other that is not about winning, but about community and doing the right thing. So, our job here at The Spiritual Politician is to look at government as a human tool we use every day. We need to consider if government is working in a way that speaks that common understanding about our connections to each other. And if it doesn't, we need to consider what might work better. Americans have had many successes over the last 231 years since our founding, and we can learn a lot from both the mistakes and successes from that time to help us make the changes we now need so desperately. Given what is going on today in government, we need to decide what to do, and we may well decide that what we need to do is reboot. To provide the examples of what has gone right and what has gone very, very wrong, we here at The Spiritual Politician have put together several different kinds of segments you'll hear on our show from time to time. The first kind is Tough Love. On Tough Love segments, we will look at the behavior of people in and around government that is very bad. We use these examples as illustrations of how nasty behavior corrupts the very expensive tool of government, making all our lives worse instead of better. If those people in government that are attracted to government can't handle the temptations, then it is up to us to ensure we change the system so that they are no longer tempted. As we do not give children objects that endanger their safety, so we should not allow the tools of government to become a danger to the moral fiber of those in government. Our second segment will give you heartwarming stories of human innovation, accomplishments that were carried out by volunteers. There are other tools for accomplishing the jobs assigned to government, and seeing what works can help us jumpstart those very much needed innovations. That's our good guy segment. The fact is, the best way to spread the good word is by seeing it happen, and these stories will warm your heart while they also excite you to the possibilities for ensuring that all of us have the safety nets we want and need for our own families and communities. And that brings us to the central issue of why this show is called The Spiritual Politician. That is how we deal with each other. If you've ever stood in line at a government bureau, you know that it is not the kind of experience you want to repeat. Certainly, it did not make you feel like you were special, unique, or loved. But if you're a Christian, then you know that Christ told us to treat others as we would him. Imagine now for a moment Christ standing in line at Social Security or at the Department of Motor Vehicles. Not a nice image. So how can a nation where most of us are Christians tolerate a government that sends that kind of message, that treats you like something the cat dragged in? Clearly, there's a long way from where we are today to where we need to go. So the question is, how do we make it possible for governance to model the reality of Christ in our lives? Can we retrain politicians? Or will what happens be that we replace what we are now using as we identify, test, and strengthen our own community ties through family, friends, business, and the examination of our own inner beings? The answer's in you. Together, we will discover what is possible for all of us. Our tough love segment tonight is about corruption in New York. I have to tell you, the government is corrupt on many levels. Our guest tonight, Doug Green, experienced this in a very personal way, and for the last 2 years has been trying to secure justice, not only for himself, but to ensure that the system actually acts justly for every one of us. Doug Green has a master's degree in political management from New York University. He was employed for a time as a legislative assistant in the office of Ada L. Smith, State Senator for Queens, New York State. Doug learned firsthand about corruption due to his experiences in the Smith office. He's going to share his insights tonight. Doug, are you there?
Hi, Melinda. I'm here.
Hi. Well, Doug, you've been through quite an odyssey in the last couple of years. But first, I'd like to start by having our audience find out something about you personally. Tell us, why did you go into politics? Was it for the money?
No, Melinda, it wasn't for the money. Two quick corrections I wanted to make. My master's degree is actually not from New York University. That's where I got my undergraduate degree. My master's degree was from a school called the Graduate School of Political Management, which is now part of George Washington University. And also, I was Edith Smith's district office manager for the brief time I worked for her.
Oh, well, thank you for that correction. I appreciate it.
Sure. No, I didn't go into politics for the money. I went into politics because since a very young age, I've been fascinated by government and the power of government to do good. And, you know, I'm one of the rare people who went into the area of politics because of the strength of ideas, as a way to implement those ideas of bringing people towards freedom.
And so freedom is a very important thing to you?
Freedom? Absolutely.
Tell us a little about how you feel about freedom.
I think freedom is the individual freedom is the prerequisite for a free society. You know, government can allow people to foster their sense of freedom. Government can let people have the tools to live a free and peaceful life and to build a harmonious society, which you know, which is not usually what government is about. Government has become, unfortunately, all about power and control over individuals rather than setting a, you know, setting the definition of a sphere to for individuals to live free lives.
Mm-hmm. What did you think you could accomplish by going to work for ADA?
What I hoped to accomplish was to help her run her office and to help serve the people of her community of Southeast Queens in New York City.
What did you think of when you first went to work there? What did you think of her and the office? Were you excited for this opportunity?
I was very excited. I was very excited to be able to do this. You know, well, now former friend of mine had was you know had known her for many years, and he knew I was looking for work, and I think he had spoken to her previously, but she hadn't been hiring at that time, and now she was, and I had a wonderful 4-hour meeting with her when I interviewed with her, and I remember I went to I think shake her hand goodbye, and she gave me a big hug. I was really excited about this.
And how long were you working for her before things started to change?
Well, I don't think I was working for very long before things started to change. I mean, I realized that first of all, the office was very disorganized. There were projects that had been piling up for several months. And I also realized that the senator's nickname, which had been given to her by the Daily Post, hadn't been given to her by that point. The Wild Woman of Albany is her nickname. And the recent media coverage has been using that a lot, but I think they didn't give her that till 2003.
Mm-hmm.
But I realized she had a very mercurial temperament, to say the least.
So you sort of accepted that she might be at some point difficult to deal with, but you didn't expect her to be impossible.
Right. I mean, difficult to deal with is kind of something that you have to expect in the world of politics. These people are used to being catered to and having their ego stroked. But this went far beyond that.
So you found it actually very routine that people in politics expected to have their egos stroked. Would you have had the sense that it was almost like they had moved up into to be members of an aristocracy?
Maybe demigods.
Demigods. Well, that's the sort of direction that I was moving in, yes. that was very much present with her.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, she, she did things in a certain way, really didn't ask questions, and, in terms of getting feedback from her on why things were supposed to be done a certain way or if, things were acceptable or they weren't, that explanation wasn't deemed necessary.
Interesting. Do you know how much a state senator in New York earns a year?
Oh, sure. I think the base salary is... I think the base salary is $79,500.
And on top of that, they have a lot of perks.
That's right. If you're a member of certain key committees or if you're a member of leadership, there are what's called Lulus, which are stipends on top of that. And I believe she was getting a Lulu and is still getting a Lulu, though apparently she's been quietly over time stripped of her leadership positions, is on top of that another 16,500. So we're talking about a total compensation package of $96,000.
Does that include medical?
I believe it does.
And what sort of medical, you don't know what kind of medical that includes, but I imagine it's probably not an HMO.
No, I would imagine it's pretty comprehensive. I mean, as a matter of fact, when I knew things were going wrong, I rushed to cash in on my vision benefit. I went and got computer glasses and regular glasses and sunglasses. I made sure to do that as soon as possible before, I was afraid of getting fired.
How many people worked in her office?
Well, do you mean at the time with me?
At the time with you, and tell us how many people normally work in the office of a senator in New York State. I want to do is I want to give the audience a sense of how the magnitude of the infrastructure we're looking at here.
Right. I mean, I don't know the figures on how many people usually work for a senator. I mean, first of all, it depends on their level of seniority. I think she's been in office since 1989 or so. I think she was elected in a special election. Also, the question is, are you in the majority or are you in the minority? And in New York State, the Assembly is run by Democrats, but the state Senate is run by Republicans. So if you're in the minority, you don't get that many people working for you. I mean, her case is also not the typical case because of her rapid staff turnover. There seems to be a lot of people, including her latest victim, who I'm sure we're going to talk about later, who also worked for her, as I did, for about a month. At the time I worked for her, I think she had two people up in her Albany office, and in her district office where I worked. But I'm sure that she had staff allocation that was greater than that. Actually, no, there were two part-time people. There was one other part-time person who I never saw, who did community meetings in part of the district. And then, of course, there was another full-time person who was assigned to the office who no one ever saw and I never saw, and who later turned out to be her boyfriend, at least at the time, who was in a no-show job. But I think that's getting a little ahead of the story.
Yes, just
right.
A little. So you're saying that there's a considerable staff that she has to work with here, and she has tremendous discretion. And it sounds like, unlike in a normal corporation, there isn't a lot of oversight. She's pretty much free to do what she wants to do.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, there's not a tremendous amount of oversight in terms of, I think, examining people's time and attendance records and seeing, if these people are actually working and doing the job that they're employed by the state Senate to do. Now, people are pretty much given free rein, and there's a tremendous amount of, tremendous amount of nepotism.
So that nobody minds if you hire your boyfriend, you hire your daughter, you hire your dog, that sort of thing.
Maybe not
the dog, huh?
Yeah, the dog might be crossing the line a little. I don't know. I certainly, in terms of a boyfriend or girlfriend, that issue has been raised with other legislators I know of, and there's definitely no prohibition against that. There might be some prohibition against a direct blood relative.
Okay. So probably maybe not your daughter's grandchild or something.
Right.
But pretty much. Now, there's another question that occurred to me as you were talking. When they have people working in the district, how much of what they're compensated, what their staff is doing, actually relates to their next election rather than to the legislative work? And is there a division made between those two things?
Well, there's supposed to be a division made.
Ah, supposed to be.
Of course. You're not supposed to be doing political work on state time. And there's, I mean, there's been some very interesting cases on that. For example, one of the Democratic state senators, a guy named Marty Connor from Brooklyn Heights, who is a well-known election lawyer, and there were accusations in early 2003, I believe, that he was having people on his staff do work on state time. But the delicious irony of this was that he was actually doing election law work for the Independence Party and Tom Golisano's candidacy, and that's supposedly what he was doing with these employees on state time. Of course, it, you know, like most things in Albany, it just kind of went away.
So would you say essentially, even if people are caught pretty red-handed doing things that are inappropriate, there's little is done about it. There's no recourse. There's no consequence for that.
I mean, there, in general, yes, there are exceptions. You know, there are a couple of district attorneys who take public corruption seriously, and there have been cases of legislators who are prosecuted by the district attorneys, and at that point, the state, you know, the state ethics bodies start taking it seriously. I mean, then there are other cases, like there was a young African-American attorney named Michael Boxley, who was chief counsel to our assembly speaker, Sheldon Silver, and he date raped someone.
Oh, but this was a rape.
That was a rape, yes.
Did he actually rape them in the legislative chamber, or was it...
No, it was in a bar in Albany, and, you know, him and this young intern were drinking, and the next thing she knew that, you know, they were in bed together, and she didn't remember what happened in the intervening period. Now, he was actually one of the people who got led out of the Capitol in handcuffs, but... ironically enough, I just saw a news item that said he has been his license to practice law has been reinstated.
How long was he disbarred for?
I think like 2 or 3 years.
Ah, I guess then rape is not a particularly it's not a problem. It's not a serious crime, right?
Well,
two or three
depends.
Years.
You know,
and
it
he's
depends,
practicing law
depends,
again.
Depends who's being raped. I mean, one of my favorite anecdotes about that incident is supposedly when the victim was talking to Speaker Silver, he just sat there with a stony expression and ate pretzels.
That's certainly interesting.
Yes.
Well, you're painting a picture here of a group of people who you would characterize as very full of themselves, very sure that they have a right to be treated as a special cast of people, and they act in exactly the way that you would then expect such a group of people to act. Would you say that's correct?
Yeah, I would say, you know, to them, other people who are not in their position are, you know, instrumentalities, people to be used. It's almost like a feudal relationship. I mean, workers in the state legislature aren't unionized. You know, coming from a libertarian orientation, I've been skeptical about the modern role of a lot of unions, but one thing this definitely taught me is that the state legislature employees need to have a union.
Mm-hmm. Well, they certainly need something. I mean, the serfs had something. They could actually, a serf, of course, could escape, and if they could escape for a year, they were free.
Right. I mean, and people, you know, you can always quit a job, but you know, for a lot of people, it's, you know, it's what they want to do, and they don't want to admit to themselves what they've gotten themselves into.
Yes. Is this what you expected, or were you shocked when you went to work there?
I mean, I was pretty shocked. I was shocked by what was going on. I don't think I expected quite a level of dysfunction, but I don't think that I don't think that that can be attributed to, you know, all 213 members of the legislature. I think the one I just wound up working for happened to be a fairly unique case.
Do you think that she's different then? And that most of these people are pretty straight?
I think most of these people are pretty straight in terms of being relatively sane on a day-to-day basis and working hard. I don't think that they're perhaps different at the core in terms of their view of people. I think they just have better self-control.
Better manners.
Right. Better manners, better self-control over, how far they take things.
And I think that this is probably the right moment for me to ask you exactly what happened.
Exactly what happened. Well, I mean, the most obvious thing was the physical and verbal abuse.
So she physically abused you, and she verbally abused you.
Myself and other staff members. I mean, there is a history going back here long before when I started working for her. Before she was elected to the state senate, I think she was a deputy clerk for New York City, and there were reports of her marrying people and, in one case, like throwing a garbage can at them.
Marrying people?
Right, that's one of the things like a city clerk can do, marry you at City Hall.
So she performed a marriage ceremony for people?
I think she would issue the marriage certificates.
And she threw garbage cans at them?
I believe in one case there was a report that she threw a garbage can at these people.
And this was before she was elected to office?
Right.
So people sort of knew her history.
Well, I don't know how much they knew her history. Generally, these news reports kind of came and went very quickly. There was another incident back in 1996 where she menaced an aide in the legislative office building with a knife. Unfortunately, this aide's boyfriend at the time, who's now her husband, was a young attorney who worked in the program council office for the assembly. And Mr. Boxley, who I mentioned earlier, the convicted rapist, and the Democratic leader at the time, Marty Connor, the election lawyer who I earlier mentioned, went to her and said, if you file charges, your boyfriend's going to lose his job with the assembly. So she kept quiet.
Uh-huh.
There was another incident in 1998 when she was involved in a traffic stop in Brooklyn and got into an altercation with the New York City police officers and bit a cop and had to be maced down.
She bit a cop?
Yeah, she bit a cop.
Where did she bite him?
I believe on the hand or the arm.
Was she arrested?
No, I don't believe she was.
Did he have to have shots?
I don't know. There was like one story in the summer of 1998 about it, then it just kind of disappeared. That was the last that was heard of that. When I went to work for her in 2002. She was very fond of these wire baskets that we would put work product in, and she got angry and she threw a wire basket. It hit my coworker in the hand. I don't believe she was aiming to hit him. I don't think it was intentional, but she just got mad and let fly with a wire basket and hit him in the hand, and he had to go to a local community health center to have that looked at. She didn't really ask about how his hand was. And there were, comments about other staff members' lack of intelligence, there are comments about my the color of my skin. She's, you know, she's African American, as was all the rest of her staff.
So your skin was too light?
Yeah, my skin's very, very white. I'm definitely a white boy.
Uh-huh.
You know, there was one incident where I got folders thrown in my face.
Could have hit your eye.
Right. Well, you know, they're folders, so they can't do that much damage. But it definitely stung in more ways than one.
And you'd only been working there for a month.
Well, I only worked for her for about a month, so this is probably a couple of weeks into it. I mean, I have notes that are written up about, you know, dates, you know, witnesses, things like that. But this is only a couple of weeks into it.
So this is something that continued to go on. It wasn't an incident that happened over a period of time where you'd been working there for 3 years. It sounds like this was fairly continuous, and it wasn't just aimed at you. It was aimed at other people as well in the office.
Right, right. I mean, everyone was abused in their own way.
And so this was her mode. She simply abused everybody.
Right, she definitely
equal abused. Opportunity abuser.
Yeah, she was an equal opportunity abuser. But, you know, one interesting thing was that it tended to happen at more so at certain times. I mean, she, at certain points in the day, she would become quite kind and lucid. But in the mornings, it was impossible to deal with her.
Well, so how long of a period during the day would you say that she was effective? Because you couldn't say that she was being effective if she was acting like this, certainly.
I don't know, maybe from noon on. I never actually looked at a clock and kind of tried to figure out when she was, you know, when she was in a rational mode or not.
How long would she normally stay during the day? Would she leave at 5?
She would sometimes leave at 5. She would stay. It would depend upon her calendar. You know, she pretty much the whole time I worked for her was, you know, was when the legislature wasn't in session. So she had political dinners to go to and meetings to go to. I mean, she, you know, all politicians keep a pretty tight schedule.
Yes, they do.
Right.
So
but,
what happened next? I mean, she assaulted you.
Right.
What did
she
do?
What did I do?
Yes.
When she assaulted me?
Yes.
I mean, I got angry. I didn't really feel I could do do much about it. I mean, I think that probably the furthest I went is, you know, at certain points when she would curse excessively. I think I once said to her, you know, Senator, you can't talk to me like that. And that, you know, temporarily calmed her down. But I didn't really feel there was anything else I could do.
So you had a feeling of helplessness. And powerlessness,
yeah.
Probably, huh?
Yeah, I certainly had that feeling, but I wanted to try and try to stick it out as long as possible. This was something I really wanted to do, and a place I felt I could, you know, be effective in doing some public service
and make a difference, which is why you were in politics in the first place.
Yeah, to make a difference, not really for, you know, power for myself or money, but rather to empower others.
Mm-hmm. So how did you happen to leave? Did you just couldn't take it anymore and you left, or?
No, I was terminated. I was fired.
Did she fire a lot of people after she had abused them?
Well, that seems to be the pattern. I mean, the latest person who's, you know, the latest person who's filed a complaint, you know, no longer works for her.
That
but,
was just the next day, right? The next day they tried to call her there and she wasn't working there anymore.
Right.
I think I read.
Right, she wasn't working there anymore. I mean, in that case, I don't know if she was fired or she quit or what happened.
That's interesting. And then that would be wrongful termination, because you're terminating somebody because they have been abused.
Well,
it certainly seems wrong.
It's wrong, but I don't believe it's illegal. I mean, if you're working for the legislature, it's kind of an at-will arrangement. So you can leave for any reason, and you can be terminated for any reason.
So they're sort of protecting themselves that way, wouldn't you say? They want to make sure that they have all the latitude they can possibly have, and people are very much at their mercy.
Right. Right. There's no, I mean, there's no protection there. I mean, people have gone to the leadership over the years about her and, you know, gotten no meaningful response.
So they fired you. What steps did you take next? Because you must have been angry.
I was angry. And kind of right after I was fired, I kind of made some connections that I hadn't made before in terms of things that were a lot more serious, actually, than physical and verbal abuse. I realized, first of all, that she had this no-show employee who I had, sent time and attendance records to Albany. I also realized there were questions about whether or not she even actually lived in the district that she represented, which is required by the state constitution.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, on the day I was terminated, we were doing a project that, I believed and still believe was doing political work on state time. I spoke with a family attorney. I started documenting things, but I didn't actually do anything for a fairly long time. My service with her ended in November of 2002, and it wasn't until the spring of 2004 when a chief of staff of hers came forward with allegations of homophobic behavior and filed a complaint with the Division of Human Rights that I actually started doing anything in terms of going to various agencies.
So they took that more seriously than they did what she had done to you, or biting the officer.
Right. What she did to me wasn't public knowledge. I didn't go to anyone. I spoke to people. It didn't seem like the relatively mild level of abuse that was directed towards me was actionable. I mean, being, having folders thrown in your face and being called a white boy,
So you felt these other things were much more substantial, and they did become public. But after
right.
they became public, then you got in touch with the other people who had been abused.
Well, I had started getting in touch with the other people who had been abused even before things went public. I got in touch with the woman who had been allegedly menaced with a knife, I think the weekend after I was terminated.
So another woman was menaced with a knife, and let's go to this most recent incident.
The most recent incident, yes.
She threw coffee in the face of a 17-year-old girl.
My original reading of the article wasn't quite accurate. It wasn't a 17-year-old girl. It was a 41-year-old woman. She actually has been in office, I think, for 17 years. That's where the confusion was from. But, she allegedly threw hot coffee in the face of an aide and pulled on the aide's hairpiece. And this woman had to go to a hospital.
So she's hospitalized several people. I'm sure that the one that was the officer that was bitten must have gone to the hospital as well.
Yep. And I would imagine he would have had to have gone to the hospital.
Now, this woman is obviously nuts. I think that most people who would see this behavior would say, this is a person who's crazy. But this is a person who's being paid substantial amounts of money to occupy a position of substantial responsibility. Now, what did you run into in terms of bringing this to the attention of the people who should have been overseen it and seen that they took action to remove her from this position? Because she's still in the position, correct?
Yep, she's still in the position. She, I believe, is running for re-election, though apparently she has a fairly serious primary opponent this time. In the past, she's had people who really didn't have a lot of name recognition or a lot of money to hire election lawyers. You know, the election law in New York State is very complex. but, I mean, the brief answer is nothing. Nothing happened. The agencies I filed complaints with usually either tried to say, well, other agencies are investigating it, or they would kind of terminate their consideration of it really before going into investigative mode. I mean, all the doors were completely shut, and I went to two district attorneys, the Legislative Ethics Commission, the Board of Elections, and the Attorney General's office.
So you did everything one could possibly do to
Yes.
bring this woman to justice, and so people could see what was going on systemically with somebody that they all knew to be crazy anyway in their own system. And that's the pattern that you saw, right?
Yep, that was the pattern. I mean, I was I mean, at one point during 2004, shortly after I filed these complaints and media started to break about the story, I spoke to the Secretary of the State Senate, who is now the respondent of a Freedom of Information Law action I'm in the process of appealing. And he said, you know, there are all these, you know, there are a lot of stories about her, and I wish I could share them with you, but I can.
Well, you all wonder if the ones you hadn't even heard yet, how bad they must be. But now there's another question that I'd like you to think about. If you could characterize what happened and what recourse you had, does it feel more like what was there was a facade than a real system to ensure that appropriate behavior took place? Because you can build something that looks like it's there to fulfill a function, but if it doesn't, it could well be there just to give people the sense that it exists.
I think in most cases it is a facade, because there are so many people who've come forward and so little that's been done. I mean, if there's any one agency that I have some faith in, it would be the courts, and I'm hoping if I can get my Freedom of Information Law action through the courts, that eventually, when it hopefully gets to the New York's highest court, the Court of Appeals, that I'll get some relief there. And the other agencies are sometimes the district attorneys. There was a profile in the New York Times over the weekend about a district attorney in Suffolk County, which is my neighboring county to the east, who's been very aggressive at prosecuting public corruption. But in general, there's not a lot of attention given to it. I mean, the legislative ethics bodies are commonly considered to be totally toothless, only acting after another agency has acted.
But they are paid.
Well, yes, they are paid.
They're paid to do it, but they don't do it, which actually makes them worse than not having anything there at all, because it gives you an illusion that there's something.
Right. I mean, there's a joint, you know, there's a joint ethics committee of the Senate and the Assembly, which considers these sorts of complaints. I mean, they have a very narrowly limited jurisdiction with a very vaguely written code of ethics, which, you know, violations of which were the basis of my complaint to them. I mean, in terms of the Attorney General's office, which is really significant and kind of one of the areas that the media hasn't touched at all, is, you know, who's responsible for letting her run amok? You know, our Attorney General is Elliot Spitzer, who probably people across the country have heard of for his, you know, aggressive prosecution of actors in the capital markets and insurance markets.
Mm-hmm.
He is, you know, the leading contender for governor. And there is a public integrity unit within the criminal division of the Attorney General's office, but it's minuscule. I mean, when I was dealing with them back in the summer of 2004, I think there are, you know, two investigators, two attorneys, a receptionist, and the head of the unit. You know, we're talking five or six people who are supposed to be investigating public corruption cases for the entire state of New York.
Well, gee, I guess they don't have any problem with corruption then, right?
Apparently not. You know, it doesn't seem to be at least a budgetary priority.
Well, and maybe perhaps in other ways, too. Another question. Here, there's a level of corruption that we see in New York in the state legislature and related bodies. Now, reasonably, you might imagine that, you know, at least one of these houses being run by Democrats, they might have insight and be able to provide some leadership to do something about what we see happening at a national level. Do you see any concern about the neocons expressed in these groups, in these people?
Well, I mean, I think that you know, most people in New York, they just don't have any. The neocon agenda has no resonance for them.
When you say it has no resonance for them, do you mean that they're not noticing what's happening? They didn't notice that there was a war in Iraq, or they didn't notice?
Oh, I think people in New York are very aware of what's going on in terms of the public policies that are undertaken by through the neocon agenda. But I think there's kind of a feeling of helplessness in New York. I mean, people can go out to rallies, and you know, certainly plenty of people donate money to the Democratic Party, but there's not a lot of feeling of what they're doing makes any difference on the national level.
Well, it certainly doesn't seem to make any difference on the state level either, because we see a lot of corruption there, so it's like Tweedledee and Tweedledum.
Right. I mean, certainly one thing working in politics will teach you is that you know, neither party has any kind of claim to, you know, more ethics and integrity.
That's a kind of scary thought, isn't it?
It's a very scary thought, because both parties, all political actors should strive for, you know, for some degree of that, and they don't. But I mean, these cases just really aren't heard about. You know, either no one complains, or if they do complain, it's a brief news story for a news cycle. I mean, I don't expect to hear anything about this story again until she's arraigned early next month.
But I bet you're looking forward to that.
Well, you know, some friends of mine have mentioned that, but I mean, I don't really have anything to do with this case. I actually just was earlier looking over the news coverage, and apparently she was charged. I mean, it's fascinating how it was done. For most people, you'd be arrested. She was mailed a summons. They mailed her a summons to appear in Albany City Court.
For assault.
What's that?
For assault.
For assault, right. Assault in the third degree, which is a misdemeanor, not a felony. And I think the maximum sentence is a year in jail. And certainly if she is convicted and sentenced, I will definitely attempt to be there and argue for the maximum possible sentence.
As you certainly should.
Yes, but as her former chief of staff, who made the allegations of homophobia, said, she'll probably get probation,
and she'll probably stay in office.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know the strength of her opponent, but I mean, she definitely could be reelected. I mean, the really horrible thing about this is that I could understand if. Her superiors were concerned about losing a seat, but it's a very solidly Democratic district.
It certainly is. And final question, if you cared about somebody, would you suggest that they go into politics?
I would say in general, no. I would say don't go into politics because, you know, it's, I mean, all my life my family has said to me, you know, why do you want to be involved in politics? It's such a dirty business.
Now you know, right?
And now I know.
Yes. Well, thank you very much, Doug.
Thank you for having me on, Melinda.
And it's been a real pleasure. I appreciate your insights, and God bless.
Thank you.
And that's our show tonight, Sunday, March 26, 2006. I want to thank you for being with us, for beginning a process with us that we hope and believe can help Americans formulate a different understanding of the function of government in our lives. If you have suggestions for either our Tough Love segment or our Good Guys segment, please contact us either online or by phone. We also accept snail mail, and that address is available on the phone and online as well. Your suggestions can be confidential, or we will be delighted to give you credit. On this show and on every subsequent show, I will end with a reading of the mission statement for America. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence indeed shall dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly all experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evidences a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. And that is our mission statement. Sometimes we're moved to act for the country we love. Sometimes we take action simply because we know in our hearts it's the right thing. This is Melinda Pillsbury Foster coming to you from BBS Radio. God bless you and your family, and may God bless America.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.